Good morning. Good to see you. Glad you're here. Certainly glad to have our visitors with us this morning. Pray the Lord will just continue to bless us, watch over us, care for us, give us the things that we stand in need of. Kind of a job comment. One of the things I have noticed in the world of my work is things have changed. People have changed. A person's word is just not there anymore. It's just not. And I don't mean that as a blanket on everybody. That's certainly not the case. But the majority of people that you come in contact with today, where 25 years ago, if a man or woman said this, you could count on it. That's not really the case today. People tell us, well, we'll do this. Well, it comes in all various shades of gray. If it doesn't rain, if I have the mind to, whatever. And one thing that's really, really changed is the integrity of people. Remember Job, on two occasions, integrity was mentioned about him. God mentioned it to Satan, a man of integrity. And Job's wife mentioned it after he had come through such hardship. Just curse God. Do you retain your integrity? And yet the scriptures confirm that through it all, he never cursed God. Why? Because he was a man of integrity. He was a man of his word. I really long for the time that we go back to being people of integrity. And I guess it starts with me, it starts with you, that when we make a vow, that we keep that vow. Even Paul talked about how that even if it was something that you said you're going to do and it was brought hurt to you, well, you needed to do it anyway because it was the right thing. If you look at the fifth chapter of Ecclesiastes, I think that's where I want to go. Fifth chapter of Ecclesiastes. Let's start at the first verse. This is not which I'd use for a text this morning, but this is just kind of leading up to it. Ecclesiastes, writing of the wise man, keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil. Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God, for God is in heaven, and thou upon earth. Therefore let thy words be few. For a dream cometh through the multitude of business, and a fool's voice is known by multitude of words. Here's where I wanted to go. When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not, or be sure that you don't not pay it. For he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Now, if you look at that, I don't think you need the Hebrew to understand what that says. Rereading it. It says, when thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, or don't refuse to pay it. For he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Better it is that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. As a minister, one of the times of vows constantly is at a wedding. And I've been blessed in 40 some odd years of pastoring churches to do quite a few weddings. To my shame, I have done far more funerals than I have weddings, but nevertheless. And one of the most important parts of a wedding is the vows. And I really stress that. Sometimes if it's people that I don't know that just have found out I'm a pastor and they want me to do the vows, then sometimes they want to write their own vows. And I tell them this, I have the right of refusal of your vows. Because if it's just, I love you, you love me, the vows should be far more than that. Matter of fact, if you look at the vows, the vows say there's nothing except death that's going to separate us. And a man and woman coming before a church, before a group of people, when they say that, they're vowing unto God and before family and friends. Far and more important to realize that God is the one that will sanction the vows. It's not going to be sanctioned by the family and friends here. And I think sometimes people forget that what they're vowing to each other is something they're vowing before God. That in sickness, in health, in any instance that might come up, there's nothing that's going to force me to leave you. I make that vow. I say that. That even death, that's the final degree of anything that will separate us. It's better not to vow a vow than to vow a vow and not keep it. Now, you're not going to believe where I want to go. I want to go to the book of Ruth. If you'll turn in your Bibles to the book of Ruth, and today, I don't know how much time we'll take with this, but I want to try to emphasize, look at the first chapter. Now, if we have time, we may go further than that, but I really am not looking to. Now, we may later on come back and look at Ruth, but I want to look at this. Now, Ruth's a beautiful book, and it's a book of vows. It's a book of bad decisions. It's a book of hardship. And it's a book that if you don't really understand what has happened in the book, then you don't understand that because of the death of some, the lineage of Christ had been severed. And if you went to practical understanding of the book, because of the death of some, the path for Christ to come by earthly means had been done away with. But praise be to God, God had a way. Isn't that amazing? How many times have you seen that? God had a way. I was talking to a minister yesterday afternoon at the funeral, and I was telling him, and I've told you this story, and I won't take long to tell it, but Carol and I had moved to Arlington right after the twins were born. We bought our first house from Sister Helen Beecham, and it was a little two-bedroom, little den-type house. It was a nice house, good house to start with, and I can't remember what our payments were, $70 or something like that, $70 a month. And when I signed those papers, I thought, we will never be able to pay for this house. It is just, I thought in my mind, this is one of the worst decisions I have ever made in the 3 or 4 years we had been married, to buy this house. We had twin boys, Mike and Mark. They were probably a year. We always had food for them. Mom and Dad would bring, they'd go to the store, and they'd find baby food on sale, and they'd get two or three big bags of baby food. And one of the things we enjoyed so much was putting it up in the cabinet and dividing it that apple crumb stuff was pretty good. I didn't mind that at all. The spinach wasn't all that good. But anyway, we had food for them. One Saturday afternoon, we saw that what we had to eat for that night was some rice. We had a box of rice. That was all we had. It's not a poor me situation, because you can live on rice. I mean, a lot of folks do. And we were about to get ready to cook that rice, and a phone rang. And it was Sister Helen. Now, my dad was in Dallas, and I knew that if I could get to my dad, I could get some money to make it through the week. And so Sister Helen said, look, we're going to we're going to Dallas for church tonight. Would y'all like to go with us? I said, well, sure. She says, I'll tell you what we'll do. She said, there's a new hamburger place that's opened up, and we'd like to take y'all to get a hamburger. And boy, that was some of the sweetest words I've ever heard in my life. She said, it's called Whataburger. First one that's been built in this area. So we went, ate our Whataburger. That was the best hamburger I've ever ate in my life. Made it to Dallas. Said, Dad, I know I just need some help. And he hit his billfold. And he gave me some money. And then we came back home with them. I don't know that they ever knew how they affected our lives. I don't know if the subject matter ever came up between us and them. But you see, and you may not believe this, I believe it, God used people to help other people. That's what he does. That's our calling. That's our calling. In this particular subject, in the first chapter of the book of Ruth, some things have happened. Let's look at the first verse. Now, it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled. Now, if you remember, Moses was so swamped with decisions that his father-in-law said, what you really ought to do is set up individuals that have a good rapport, a good reputation, godly men, and let them make those decisions. And you set them up, and that's what had happened. As a matter of fact, until the time of Samuel, the judges ruled. And what it means they ruled is that they made decisions regarding the children of Israel. So it says, in the days when the judges ruled, so that gives you a time frame of when this occurred. And actually it occurred a little over 1,300 years before the birth of Christ. There was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah. Now understand this, that's the center of the Jewish nation. That's Bethlehem. That's where Christ will be born. The prophets had told them, they were aware that one day the Messiah would be born, and it's in Judah, and it's just the center of all the Jewish nation. And the great famine came up. And when something like that occurs, the decision is, do we stay here and tough it out, or do we hunt something else? And that's a very important decision, because most times, God wants us in the middle of his love and his graciousness and his mercy. And he can do that in the famine. He can do that in a time of plenty. But sometimes people get so anxious for better things, and they hear of better things, and they make a choice that will affect them greatly. That's not too much different than us in the church. Sometimes we in the church enjoy the fellowship. We enjoy the mercy and the grace of God. And yet when some hard times come, some people look for better things. Some people look for better grounds. Whether it's another Primitive Baptist church or whether it's a church of an entirely different denomination, they're willing to give up what they had, what was their rightful place in a church, for something that might be. You ever known anybody like that? I've known people like that. I've got family like that. I've got those that will give up a comfortable place in the church of Jesus Christ and try to take vanity after vanity in the world of so-called religion. Certain men of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn or lived or moved into the country of Moab. Moab was a terrible place to be. But if you see famine, what you think is, well, Moab can't be all that bad. There must be some good things about that. So I'll give this up, this thing that I enjoyed all my life, this thing that I have been raised in. I'll give that up and I'll go to Moab. Decisions sometimes come very hard and very, very strong. I'm going to ask you today to pray for the Lane family. especially Sister Taylor. They're making decisions. They're looking at school and advancing her education, and that's only rightfully so. That at an age, at a time where that's just what you do. But my prayer for them is, and I promise you, I will continue to pray this, that the Lord will lead Taylor right where she needs to be. If it's Oklahoma, that's fine. If it's anywhere else, that's fine. As long as that's where the Lord wants her and where she can grow in honesty and in truth. Brother mentioned in the prayer about truth. You know, a lot of people will turn their back upon truth in order to gain something that's half truth. There's something that sounds good, something that sounds like it may be somewhat better. And the truth is the truth, no matter how you look at it. And this man in Bethlehem, Judah, is in the middle of his countrymen, is in the middle of his family, is in a place where if it gets hard enough, there's people going to take care of him. And they leave that behind by his decision, and they go to Moab. You know what Moab means in the Hebrew? Incestual. Does that kind of give you an idea where they're headed? Does that kind of give you an idea of what's coming on? We give up something honest, we give up something good, we give up something that is wondrous, and we say, well, you know, that's really not all that bad. Surely there's some good things about that. And they turn their back upon that, and they go into something they had no idea where they were going. Man's name was Elimelech. Elimelech, if you look at the Hebrew, is interpreted as God is king. Second verse. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi. Naomi in the Hebrew means pleasant. You ever known any Naomis? My life has been full of Naomis. This women in my life, especially in the formative years. Mothers in Israel that just all they wanted to do was to help you. All they wanted to do was just give you comfort and give you peace. Naomi, pleasant. And it kind of gives you an idea of what she was about. Name of the two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. Let me just give you a question. If you had a son and you were going to give him a name that means weak, sick, afflicted, would you pick that name? That's what Mahlon meant. Can you imagine a mother, or probably a father in this situation, picking the name of his child, said, I'm just going to call him Mahlon because he looks kind of weak, he looks kind of sick, he looks kind of afflicted. And the other boy was named Chilion. Chilion did not get a better deal. Chilion meant pining, sorrowful. Can you not see that this is set up for great, great tragedy? Can you not see that how important it is for decisions we make? That decisions we make can be formative in our life. They can point us either to good things or they can point us to bad things. And the way that we make decisions as God's children is that we spend our time upon our knees praying to God to give us direction. Now, let me tell you this. It doesn't matter how old you are, doesn't matter how young you are, we are all faced with hard, hard decisions. That note from Sister Shana this morning, it just her heart was reaching out for some direction, for some unnamed reason in her life, and that she's standing there like, Lord, which way do I go? And you know, every time we gain that position, one thing always happens. He gives us direction. It may not come immediately. It may not come in the first month, but it comes. And when we wait patiently, just like Moses at the Red Sea, we wait for the hand of God. We are far better for it. Mahlon and Chilion, two men, and I just get this mental picture. One's sick all the time, and one's just distressed all the time, and they press on. They came to the country of Moab and continued there. Can you imagine going to a strange country? You don't know their customs. They're not godly people. They worship idols, and so there's not a place like they could go to the temple or rather to the tabernacle when they were in Bethlehem, Judah, or they could go to some place that they knew, they understood. But now they're in a foreign country, and they have no place to worship their God. They have no place to go. They have to do it in the house. And they see all this incestual things happening around about them. And it's just a new horrible world that they find themselves in. And then something bad happens. You can just almost tell it was coming. Third verse. And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. And she was left with her two sons. That's what she has to take care of. That's a sad situation. That's not something to gloss over just real quickly. If Naomi is a peaceful, loving individual, then she loved Elimelech. She loved him. It was Elimelech's decision as head of the household to move from Bethlehem, Judah to Moab. And it was his decision to take his whole family from things that they were settled in and things that they were blessed in, and go to a country that they had no idea. They didn't know the language, didn't know the customs, and then they put them right there, and then he died. And I know in my heart, Naomi mourned for his death. In the next 10 years, something happened. The two sons, Malan, Kilian, they took one wives of the women of Moab. That was a great, terrible, distressful thing in that day and time. You know why? Because those women did not know the customs of Elimelech's people. They did not know the situation. And I'm not saying God hadn't got people in every nation, kindred, and tongue, because the Revelation tells me that it does. So I'm not saying that not some people there knew who God was, or at least was able to tell that there was a God, that maybe they can't name him, and they can't tell everything about him like the Jews could, but they just knew there was something better than that idol sitting there on that stump. And they took them two wives. Sixth verse. Then she arose. Oh, let me back up. Fourth verse. They took them wives to the women of Moab. And the name of one was Arpa. If you looked at the Hebrew of Arpa, that means mane. And I get this picture. I get this picture of a beautiful head of hair. Beautiful black head of hair, which would have been, the people of that time. And so that was Arpa. And the name of the other, Ruth. And Ruth means in the Hebrew, friend. Naomi means pleasant. Ruth means friend. Fifth verse. Malan and Kilian died also, both of them, and the woman was left of her two sons and her husband. Great distress, great problems. They had come from Bethlehem, Judah, and they had come to Moab, and they had great expectations of the new life that awaited them. But Elimelech died, and the men took wives from that country, and it wasn't long till they died, and everything that was going to give any sign of progress or satisfaction to Naomi was taken away. All the help that would have come from her two sons, because she was a widow, was taken away. And here's another tragic situation. Because they're not home anymore, her kinfolk can't give her help, and they don't even really know where she is. And she's in Moab, and she's in a strange country. And if you've never been in a strange country, then you really don't understand. And I'm not talking about something south of the border or in Europe. I'm talking about right here, where you align yourself to in situations where it's just a strange, strange country. The things they do are not like you are accustomed to. The songs they sing are not the songs that you sing. I really appreciated yesterday the comments about how that this woman stood for the songs of Zion and the songs that have been sung generation after generation. And I think we do that today. I think we still enjoy the songs that have some meat to them, songs that have some meaning to them. I don't mind some of the fast songs. Some of them I don't enjoy. But I tell you what, you take me back to Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound. There's something there that will not pass you by. They talked about her being there with Sister Helen and then the deepened dementia, and they would come and she wouldn't know them, but they would begin to repeat the 23rd Psalm, and she would sing every word. And they'd start to sing a song of old, a song of Zion, a song of her childhood, and she'd know every word and her voice would rise. You see, friend, there's some things of a positive nature that you just do not lose. Ground your children in those things. Ground your children, not in the new Xbox or the new biggest toy, but in the things that will last them through the hard times of life. And I just lost the attention of some of the children who wanted that Xbox. Let me tell you, friend, what you need most of all is things to hold on to. Things that will not pass you by. You buy that Xbox, you know what's going to happen. They're already working on a new one. And when the new one comes out, you're going to have the new one. It just doesn't stop. Doesn't stop. And Naomi is left without any help, without anything of a natural sustenance. And then she gets some good news. I remember Carol and I in 1968. We're having all kinds of troubles. Our home was in a shambles. We didn't know if we were going to make it or not. Two young boys. And we sat on this. There's a church in Oklahoma City. And it'll be far enough away that I won't be dependent on my mom and dad. And she won't be dependent on her mom and dad. And we'll have to be dependent on each other and the Lord. And here's the deal we made. We're having a singing school. We'll go there. A beautiful family gave us a rent house to stay in for the week. We'll go there. Monday morning, I'll get them all settled in, and Tuesday morning, I'll start hunting a job. And if I can find a job, we're going to move. Tuesday morning, I got like 4 interviews, and Wednesday morning, I had a job. You see, God has a purpose. He has a reason. He has something in your life that He values far more than something of this world that you can hold in your hands. And Naomi is alone. And she gets some good news. Year 1990, I was working for a company in Oklahoma City. And I had knew that they were looking at probably transferring me back to Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I hadn't said much to Carol about it because there's no sense getting your hopes up if it doesn't happen. You see, men can be happy just about anywhere. You just give us a few things and we'll be all right. But women, they long to go home. They long to go home. And in conversation after conversation, that longing would come out of her heart. And she just, I wish we could go home. I just wish. I did pastoral care of a church that allowed us to stay 3 more years, and that didn't make her happy at all. I want to go home. One of the happiest times that I have ever seen her in my life was when I come home that day in February, and I said, "How quick can you get this house packed up?" She said, "Why?" And I said, words that the Christian longs to hear. We're going home. We're going home. You see, friend, make this country, Moab, as comfortable as you can, but it's not home. The home is where the Lord is. Home is where the Lord has promised to be. Home is where He is. That's home. That's home. We're going home. Word came to Naomi. The famine is over. It's an abundance of everything you need. Back in Bethlehem, Judah. And here comes decision time. She begins to talk to her daughter-in-laws. Sixth verse. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab how the Lord had visited his people in Bethlehem, Judah, in giving them bread. Wherefore she went forth out of the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return into the land of Judah. Eighth verse. And Naomi said unto her two daughters-in-law, Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. And what she's doing is giving them encouragement. You go home. You go back to your mother's house. You go back to the land that you know, because I'm going home. I'm going to a place I'm familiar with, and you don't know what it's going to be like over there. She said, The Lord grant you that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voice and wept. And they said unto her, Surely we will return with thee and to thy people. And Naomi said, Turn again, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there yet any more sons in my womb that you may be your that they may be your husbands? Turn again, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband also tonight, and should also bear sons, would you tarry for them until they were grown? Would you stay for them from having husbands? Nay, my daughters, for it grieveth me much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord is gone out against me. And they lifted up their voice and wept again. I think they're showing great love that they have for her. All that she's gone through, and all that has happened, and all the things they have done, she has done for them. And they lifted up their voices and wept against, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. What does clave mean? Oh, that means hold tight. I'm not going to let you go. They can't break my embrace. And Orpah, don't feel bad about Orpah. Orpah's going back home. She's going back where she's accustomed to. She doesn't know what's over there, but there's something about the relationship of Ruth and Naomi that Ruth will not let Naomi go. And she said, Behold, Naomi said to Ruth, Behold, thy sister-in-law is gone back unto her people and unto her gods. Return thou after thy sister-in-law. And Ruth said, and what follows is about. What follows is something you hear quite often at a wedding. This is not a wedding vow, but it's beautiful. And a lot of people like to bring it into their wedding, and I find no fault in that. But what this is a Moab lady that has married a son of a Jew, and the son has died, and she has such love and graciousness for her mother-in-law that she's going to make a vow. Have you ever made a vow like that? Have you ever loved somebody so much, so endearing? And maybe it wasn't your husband. Maybe it was your mother-in-law. Maybe it was your father-in-law. And the love for it just grew so strong that it didn't know family ties anymore. It was just overwhelming. If you can see some part of that, that's what the relationship of Naomi and Ruth is. And here's what the vow that Ruth made. Nobody is standing before Ruth saying, you ought to make this vow. Nobody is standing before Ruth saying, these are the words you ought to say. You ought to utter them. You ought to say them. No, this comes from the heart of Ruth. And Ruth has in her mind and in her situation that this is how I feel. This is the vow I make with my daughter, my mother-in-law. Entreat me not to leave you. Don't force me to leave you. Or to return from following after thee. Naomi, don't make me stop following you. I'm going to follow you wherever you go. I don't know the path. I don't know what's out there. But what I do know is my love for you is so strong that I'm not going to turn my back on it. I make this vow right now. She didn't say before God, but you can be assured it's before God. I make this vow. Don't make me leave you. I will follow you anywhere. Nothing wrong if you want to use that as a between a husband and wife, but put it in its proper context. This is a maiden from Moab that is best friends and loves a woman that is Jewish, and she's going back to Bethlehem, Judah, and Moab, the lady from Moab, Ruth, is going to leave everything behind, and she's going to follow her mother-in-law. Now understand this. This is two women on a really hard, arduous journey, but they're going to the home of one of them. What is it about your home that draws you back there every night? Well, it's a roof. It's a place. You got some food. It's a couple of... But you know, really, there's more than that. This place that we live in now, and we've lived in many places in our married life, this is our favorite to date. Because we sit out and we see and we pray quite often, Lord, thank you for what you have given us. Thank you for what this home that you have given us. Thank you, Father, for this beautiful backyard that you have given us. And we don't really thank you for all the cats that have showed up in our house, but they're kind of fun to watch. But we thank him for everything that he has blessed us with. And Ruth said, I'm going to follow you. She said, entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee, for whither thou goest, I will go. How many times have you ever heard that? A lot of songs have that. Well, that comes from, it comes from the vow of Ruth. She said, for whither thou goest, I will go. Now, you notice in that, Ruth's not saying, I want us to take this route. I really like her to do. So what she said is, wherever you're going to go, I'm going to go. I'm going to follow in your footsteps. I'm going to walk beside you. I'm going to be right there with you. You can count on me. She vowed that. She vowed it. And whither thou lodgest, I will lodge. Look at what she's saying. Where you go, I'll go. Where you lodge, I'll lodge. I will become part of you. I will be an extension of you. A woman that loves God. A woman that worships Him in truth and sincerity. A woman that is part of His people. And here's a Moabitess, a mistress that didn't understand anything, but because she's seen this honorable, godly woman, she says, I'll follow you anywhere. Don't tell me that your lives don't make a difference. Don't tell me that people are not watching how you live. Don't tell me that people are not seeing or listening to how you talk, what you say, how you point, how you look at others. People see all of that. And from that, they make a formative opinion of what you're about. What you're about. And evidently, Naomi, in her life, had shown it to Ruth. And Ruth turned her back on her heritage. She turned her back on her home place. She turned her back on all of the idolatry in Moab. And she's going to follow this godly woman. Nobody forced her. Nobody put her in an arm lock and made her do it. Nobody put her in a headlock and made her do it. She decided she'll do it. I love her. I love the way she lives. I want to be a part of it. I'll go where you go. I'll live where you live. And then look what she says. Thy people shall be my people. You notice what she said? I'm not going to be satisfied with anybody else. I'm not going to listen to the siren song of things that are a promise of a cotton candy religion. Your God shall be my God. I'll go where you go. I'll live where you live. She said, thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. And that would have been enough. That would have been overwhelming. That would have been plenty, but that wasn't all she said. She said, whither thou diest, will I die. You see what she's saying? from this moment forward, I vow to you that I will follow you. I will be with you. I will go back to your homeland. I'll live where you live. I'll worship your people will be my people. I'll worship your God. And when life is over, when it's all done, where you die is where I will die. Show me proof somebody made her do that. Show me proof that somebody just forced her to say those things. No, they came from the heart. They were a vow before God. When she saw Ruth, or Naomi saw that Ruth was steadfastly minded. You know what that means? It means she's not going to change her mind. She is focused. She is pointed on the relationship with her and her mother-in-law. When she saw that she was steadfastly minded to go with her, then she left speaking unto her. There was nothing else left to say. May I visit with you just a little bit regarding your membership in a church? I realize we have some that are memberships in other places today. I don't think this is any less effective or any less noteworthy than if you're a member of Trinity Baptist Church. But do you realize that when you came to join the church, and it didn't matter how old you were, I was about 10 years old when I joined the church, and I have not always, nor many probably of the years that I've been a member of the church, I've not really been a really good member of the church. But nevertheless, when I was baptized, and I was baptized into the church. Now, let me tell you this. If you look back after the day of Pentecost when 3,000 came, what does it say? They were added to the church. So when you come and you're baptized into the church, you're baptized into a membership in the church. You see, I say that because some believe if you're baptized, that means you'll go to heaven in eternal and forevermore. You'll be of Christ. You've made that decision. Peter says, by the inspiration of God, baptism is not for putting away of the filth of the flesh, but is the answer of a good conscience towards God. Jesus Christ was baptized. If in fact man's baptized for eternal salvation, was that the same for Jesus Christ, the very Son of God incarnate? No, not at all. What happens is you come to an understanding of how important the church is, how much you love the church, how much you want to be a part of it, and you're baptized into the church. What we don't understand sometimes is when we're baptized, we're making a vow. We're saying unto the Lord, where you live, I'll live. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people. Where I die will be in resemblance of how you died. Where I'm buried, the body's there, but the soul and spirit has already gone home. The soul and spirit is in the midst of the people of God as they stand around the throne singing praises unto Him. From this, I've got to quit. From this, we see the importance of a vow. We see the importance of Ruth making a vow unto Naomi, and to be very sure, Ruth lived out that vow forever. It's so important for us if we make a vow that we follow through on the vow. I thank you for your attention. Ask you to pray for me and mine who are in the throne of grace. As we stand and sing some suitable hymn, if there are those that have a desire to join the church, then this is your opportunity. After we sing a verse, we'll take the right hand of fellowship. Somebody have a selection?